Yeah, I was born and raised in Holyoke, Massachusetts, Western Massachusetts. And I came out here in 1975 when I was invited to start with one other person what would become the fifth fine arts major. That was going to be a creative writing program. And I thought it was probably a stopover on my way elsewhere, more than likely back to the East Coast. And here I am, however many years later this is. And yeah, most people, I think of myself as Midwestern, as from here. And you know that I think every story in the new collection is set in northern Michigan.
Yeah. And that seems pretty typical for your work, fair to say?
Set here?
Yeah, Michigan as almost a character in your books.
Yeah, it's definitely a character. I mean, it's trying... relocate my stories, put them elsewhere, and they cease to exist. It's a character itself in the same way, I suppose, that you could say Dublin is a character for Joyce. So if you're reading Dostoevsky, you're reading about St. Petersburg, and it's not only is it a character, it forms behavior, as Jose Ortega y Gasset said, tell me the place in which you live, and I will tell you who you are. And so, yeah, I live by that.
Talk about using absurdity in literature. And that can be the same thing as humor, but because you use some of that element in your work as well.
Yeah, I hadn't ever thought of it as absurdist, but I believe that, well, first of all, the French have a word. It's called chantefleur, and it means to laugh and cry at the same time, a concept I love. And it's a natural relaxant, you know, it allows the reader to step more easily into the fray.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you talk about one of the greatest American absurdist novels, of course, is Catch-22, and eliminate the humor from that book. And I doubt anybody can get through it.
This is what, your 11th book?
Yes.
And you've got, in your background, you've got poetry, essays, novels, but you are returning more and more to short stories. Is that your most comfortable genre?
It's the genre I love most. I began as a poet and wrote only in that genre for probably the first 30 years of my writing life. And then when I was given a sabbatical some years ago, I promised myself that if I finished a poetry collection early, I try prose fiction for the first time, and having done that, I never looked back. I then went to long fiction. I went poetry, short fiction, long fiction, and then now the pendulum has swung back to this place that I love most. That's the short story, which I think most people would agree is closer to poetry than it is to the novel. You can do things in the short story. There's an intensity of language, for example, or a degree of lyricism that is unsustainable in longer fiction. So it seems to suit me well. My wife keeps asking me now if she thinks the pendulum will swing all the way back and that I might finish my writing career, writing poems. And I so unequivocally said, no, there's no chance of that. But I'm not so sure anymore. We'll see.
Yeah, where it leads you. Is that what you find your stories do for you? I think I read somewhere that, you know, you might start with a character or an image or a word, but it's the character that leads you. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's the place itself. Sometimes it's character. Rarely is it the plot. I mean, if we're talking about story structure, those are the three elements. And it rarely, nothing ever comes full blown to me. In fact, I have no clue where I'm headed, but believe that if I can write an opening sentence that's interesting enough for me, then I can get a story, having no idea where it's headed. And this is true when I was writing poems. If I could get an interesting first line, mm-hmm. I would just follow wherever that led me. With the short story, that first sentence announces what's possible in the next, and the next after that, and the next after that. And in the process, story forms. So mm-hmm. It forms mostly out of character and place, not out of the plot, almost never.
And that first sentence is always the hardest, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's
most
it's,
intimidating, perhaps.
Well, it sets up. There's a writer named Stephen Milhauser who says, in that grain of sand is contained the entire beach that holds that grain of sand. In other words, it's a condensed version of the whole story. Mm. So it's for me the single most important sentence of the story.
And you've said that you've never written a sentence that you haven't revised.
Yeah, I think that's true. I tell my students all the time that that quoting the poet William Matthews, that revision isn't cleaning up after the party. Revision is the party, and you know it's where that next version occurs, and on and on. And so I'm always going right back to the beginning, to word one. I don't get up in the morning and find myself beginning, say, on page 2 or page 9 or page 16. I go right back to word one and read it through to that place and then hopefully get some traction and move it forward. And, I mean, maybe there's a sentence here and there that has survived, but generally no.
Well, I wonder if that's part of why you're a short story maestro rather than wanting to deal with longer fiction if you start from page 1 each and every time.
Exactly. Yeah, you're on page 400. That's good. Well, that day's shot.
Does it get harder or easier with time and experience? Do your self-demands go up?
It's harder. Absolutely, it's harder. When I was first starting out, I knew absolutely nothing, and so I was receptive to everything. And you don't want to write the same story. I mean, self-imitation can morph into a kind of self-mockery almost. You know, here's another story spoken by a young boy in northern Michigan. You want to keep breaking through that next place where you haven't yet arrived. And so, yeah, the bar is set higher with every next story, and I want that to be true.
So describe this collection to us, The Goatfish and the Lover's Knot, 10 stories. Are you able to create a story that describes the stories? Describe the book for us.
This would be a much better question for me to answer about a year or 2 years from now. Some of these stories are so new. I had just recently, a year ago, beginning in January, maybe the single greatest writing stretch of my life. In any genre. They just came. It was a kind of fire I hadn't experienced for a long time. And, well, some of the things we've already talked about. I mean, the stories are set up here, and I love characters who dare to hope against hope, even when the odds are so stacked against them. And so there's what I hope is a compassionate character development for all of them. As I said, they're set here in northern Michigan. The title itself is from a story, and I'm looking at a galley right now, and I'm looking into the eons, into the firmament, into all the stars up there, and the goatfish and the lover's knot refer to two constellations. And so the stories are sort of set against that, too. I'm not exactly sure when the motif started, not with this book, but maybe with the world of a few minutes ago. And it's something that I like to do. I like to walk out at night and particularly, say, under the northern lights and look up just to remind myself how small I am and maybe provisional, but certainly passing through. And there's that element, too, the time. As Jim Harrison says, time rushes towards me. It has no brakes. And, or Galway Canal, who says, here I sat by the river's steaming boulders and considered time, which is next to nothing, merely what vanishes and yet can make one's elbows nearly pierce one's thighs. And I've been thinking about that quite a lot. It keeps coming up in the work. That's implicit here, too. There's one story that's called On This Day You Were All Your Ages. It's a story in which a woman relives her entire life. And it ends with an image of her walking across the backyard, the first step she's ever taken toward her mother, who's waiting with her arms out. So it goes all over the place in time. That sense that time is not only in the present, but it's stereoscopic. It's composite. That the past ticks inside the present, and that's one of the concerns of the book too.
And it's 10 stories. I've noticed some of your other collections are 10 stories. Is that like a magic number for you, or it just kind of works out right that way?
No, that was random. And it just happened. Yeah, my first story collection, Wanting Only to Be Heard, I think has 17 stories. And that came out in 1992. Mm. And a lot of those stories are much shorter. And one thing I've discovered, having written stories for all these years now, is that my comfort length shakes out at about usually 18 to 24 pages. Though the longest story I've ever written is in this book, in the new book. Mm-hmm. It's called Calchek and Priest, and it's 26 pages. And so the stories, the 17 stories, compromise about the same number of pages.
Do any of these characters, once the story's written and rewritten and sent off to the publisher and appeared in print, do these characters still talk to you? Do they visit you in the night sometimes?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. In fact, I said to somebody, I'm just back from Oregon and for 2 weeks out there teaching, and I was talking some about characters, and I'm a Luddite. I belong to the Lead Pencil Club. I know nothing about technology, and I wasn't even sure. I pulled my wallet out of my back pocket, and I said, remember those plastic inserts in the wallets where we used to put our pictures of our kids, pictures of our husbands or wives, people we love? And I said, because I can't do it on a phone, I only have a flip phone and don't know how to do any of this, I said, maybe what I'd like to do is take the pictures of my characters and just put them in my wallet. And then I could show a picture and say, do you remember Marley Ann and Riley Jack? Remember that time they stole that horse? And that's how I feel about the characters. And so, yeah, they do come up in conversation. And if I were to write a novel, I might even think about my existing characters, short story characters, and make them part of a larger tapestry.
You know, Jack, I think that's a story in itself, a writer pulling up a wallet with pictures. There's something to that. Don't let that go.
All right.
And as a teacher, you teach writing. What's the most important lesson, surely from experience, that you pass on to your students?
Well, I tell them to make it matter. Yeah. I tell them to make it beautiful. I tell them that two things are involved, talent and a fanatical, hardcore work ethic, and that the second half of the equation is much more important than the first, that talent has to discover its equivalent in a hardcore, persistent, hardcore work ethic. And if they work on it and work on it and work on it and work on it, the chances are that they're going to get better. And they need to be the ones who are standing in the end, not to give up on themselves, just trust that this will happen for them if they stay at it. I also tell them, and I underscore it often, that it might turn out to be the single most difficult thing they've ever done. It has been for me.
I think that that's true for just about any creative. It's the thing that's hardest for you to do, but that you love the most, and maybe because it's so hard, most satisfying when you're done.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And in that way, it becomes sort of reward in itself. Just and the routine. I work with a writer who was on a panel, and there were several people up on the panel, and Frank Gaspar said to him, his advice was touch it every day, meaning the keyboard, just touch it every day, to make it part of your life, or in my case, the center of my life. And I try to do that. I can't. We can be full-time human beings, and that's a good preparation for writing, but we can't be literally full-time writers because we have a life to live as well. But I make an effort in one way or another to touch it every day. Mm. And I tell them this too. Yeah. And I've said this before in interviews, that nothing buoys my spirits more than to see my students do well, land a story in a good journal, or to publish their first story collection or novel or book of poems or whatever that might be. And my wife and I are bibliophiles. We're book collectors, and I don't know how many thousands. I've kind of lost count. But I have one shelf that is designated only for books by my former students.
Mm.
And I would give away all the other books I own, and a lot of these are first edition signed copies, just to keep that one book of that one shelf of books by my students, which now exceeds my wingspan. So it's not just a single shelf anymore. It's gone over deep into a second one now. And that's how I feel about teaching, that at some point the two became inextricable, and to try and define myself as one or the other, it isn't feasible. They're sort of locked in as part of the same thing.
That's a big part of your legacy.
Yeah, and I love that it is. So I'm at this point in my life happy to give back and happy that I've dedicated a good part of my life to doing that.
Any kind of a book launch planned?
Well, this is still in the early stages. I know I'll be in Portland and I'll be in Seattle, and I'll be doing readings, talks, Q&As, whatever, in Michigan. And I prefer my driving gigs. I like the in-state gigs, whether they be at, you know, universities or libraries, whatever, even mm-hmm. even reading groups. If I can drive, I like it better. I'm not. The flying has sort of gotten to me. But I will be off probably in Austin, Texas. Chances are pretty good that I'll be in Massachusetts and Connecticut. So it's kind of firing up now.
Nice. Well, I hope you make it to Kalamazoo at some point, too.
Yeah, I hope so. And I have the publicist is working on all of this. So we'll get it straight, and pretty soon, then I'll hit the road.
Okay. Well, thank you for spending some time with us, Jack. It's been good to talk to you. The Goatfish and the Lover's Knot.
Thank you, Zinta, for calling and for talking with me. It's much appreciated.